Good afternoon and welcome to Arts Live and Local here on the stations of Coast Community Radio. We're starting out the show with a little group called Us Lights. They're going to be appearing January 24th at the Fort George with Dog Heart, and we're hearing their cut, Life. Arts Live and Local is brought to you in part by the Columbia River Coffee Roaster. It wholesales fresh roasted coffee since 1992 at 279 West Marine Drive at the Old Finnish Meat Market. With Three Cups Coffee House up front, espresso, coffee, homemade baked goods, Wi-Fi, and gifts, it's open every day. And it's also, Arts Live and Local is brought to us also with the support of Coast Weekend. It's your source for arts and entertainment news in the Columbia Pacific. It's published weekly in the Wednesday Chinook Observer, the Thursday Daily Astorian, and online at coastweekend.com. And I'm Kate Brister. I am sitting in this afternoon for hostess Carol Newman, who is out today. Big little shoes to fill, but I've got a terrific show. Carol made all the arrangements before she left, and it is jam-packed. We're starting off this afternoon. We actually have three shows in one today. Excuse the paper rustling. We are starting off hearing about a terrific art show. It's multi-artist, multi-organization collaboration taking place between the Cannon Beach Arts Association and the Lightbox Photographic Gallery in Astoria. We are very happy to have with us in the station today artists Don Frank, Roger Dorban, and Andrea Mace. Can you all say hello?
Hi, Kate.
Hello.
How are you?
welcome to our studio today. We're going to be talking about the show that brought all of you together, and that's Confessions. And it's not only taking place with some installations here in Astoria, but also in Cannon Beach. A big project, a big thing to organize.
Yes, we are hosting a show, a reception, tomorrow night, Saturday from 5 to 7. At the Cannon Beach Gallery in Midtown Cannon Beach, and it is, as you mentioned, a collaboration between the Lightbox Photographic Gallery, some of its members, and then some of the photographers from the Cannon Beach Arts Association. And we kind of invited the artists to be in this show, and Andrea and I actually put the show up on the walls last week, and I can say that it's quite entertaining, evocative, and maybe eye-opening.
Well, I was on the website to get a little gander at some of the installation. I talked to Michael. He's also helping you curate at Lightbox or something, and was aware of that, and just said they're still busy rearranging and putting up things. It's a very dynamic show. I saw extremely powerful photographs in black and white, and Roger, your piece Confessions, I believe it's your piece Envy, is used for the, is this yours?
That's mine.
Your piece, excuse me, right. I beg your pardon. Pretty deep confession to admit to right off the bat, Envy.
So the show is titled Confessions, and actually, again, Andrea and I kind of developed that concept. And the idea behind that was really to try to push maybe some boundaries or even buttons in some artists to come up with some really compelling, interesting imagery. And I would say most of the photographers have definitely done that. My piece, I have two pieces in the show, and they really kind of, I focused in on the seven deadly sins. And I suppose my two favorites, lust and envy. And so just the conceptualization and production of those was pretty fun and interesting. And so I'm pleased, and I hope other people enjoy them too.
Andrea, you had quite a lot of artists to choose from and works to pick to be able to gather together a group of 10. We've got 10 artists that are showing in between the two galleries, yes?
I think it's 11. Oh, is it 10? We might have lost one. Yes, I think that Don was instrumental in selecting the artists. I was mostly just helping him curate the actual work onto the walls.
Talk to us about your pieces.
Well,
your confessions.
So I used to be strictly a black and white photographer and was very much a purist. And in the last few years, I've just been working with my cell phone as my camera and capturing little snippets of life as it unfolds. I'm a mother and very busy, and so I am not a studio artist. I don't have the luxury of just going into a meditative studio space and creating. I need to take my moments where they come. And so this work is, it's a series of 5 or 6 photos that are just from walking around in my neighborhood with some of the neighborhood kids, and kind of a confession of how quickly time moves by and how easy it is to miss the magical moments in each day.
Excellent. Roger, talk to us a little bit about your work in the series.
Okay. well, initially, when I received the invitation, I, of course, was honored to be selected. Usually, I'm part of a jurying system, and, you know, you take your chances. But it was nice to be automatically selected for a show, but I was a bit ambivalent about the title. I thought, well, I don't really have confessions. And I thought, personally, I've already confessed. I don't need to confess again. But then I started looking back and thinking about different bodies of work from the past, and recalled a series that I did at a theatrical center in Portland called Dreamswell. it was run by Susan Banyas, who now happens to be who's a dancer and now happens to be an Astoria resident, which is a great addition to this community. Anyway, she would invite people to do personal, what shall we say, sort of therapeutic renditions of things that had happened to them, a catharsis, if you will, of based on an actual life experience, and they would act them out on stage, you know, rehearse for it, and then do a performance. And in my case, I documented a piece for a friend who was acting out a traumatic event that had happened to him some years ago that did have elements of shame and doubt and confession to it. And so I did a series of those photographs of him, combining them into a four-piece photograph that I think works pretty well with the theme.
At what point do you feel, with something like this, where it's all started out as, if not your own personal, particular confession, so to speak, but your own ideas, your own experiences, like Andrea, about you and life there in your neighborhood, and, you know, things that you've had in your past, Roger, and the things that you're debating right now, thinking about, Don, your own issues with the 7 deadly sins, at what point can these pieces, they transcend your own personal expression about what you wanted to say about yourself, and what makes it, again, become a universal point for the audience?
Well, I think each piece starts out from our own heart as artists. But once we put it out there, it's really the world's to interpret and take in how they want. And I think in my particular, I mean, I've seen the whole show. Some are very maybe vague or general, you know, and there's a lot of, and some are quite specific on what maybe they are confessing and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure when different people go see the exhibit, something different will strike each person as important. Mm-hmm. And there's not really a goal to get people to clear their their conscience, right? But
I think art is cathartic, though, and meditative, and you have to come away at least feeling touched by something. I believe that's certainly possible.
It is possible we'll set up a confessional in the gallery for the reception.
Oh, a little street theater. That would be excellent. Well, so,
I was just going to say, with my piece, the performance that was given that I photographed was strictly nonverbal, and it relies on conveying emotion through body movement and gesture. And I think that in the 4 photographs that I chose, you get that sense of a confession of something that's very painful being expressed, but it's strictly through bodily gesture. And I think that's something that everyone who looks at the show can identify with, because we recognize the kind of postures and body language that we have when we're feeling ashamed or we're wanting to confess or needing to confess.
Roger, were these particular photographs black and white?
Yes, black and white.
These are the ones that I saw. Yes, they're very powerful shapes.
Thank you.
Not only as human emotion, but just as shape and color. Mm-hmm. Just if you just looked at them from that point of view, they're extremely artistic. And then, of course, the emotional content that's on top of that, they're very powerful. Talk to me a little bit about what it was like to just get a show like this together with this many artists in two locations that aren't that close together. It's quite an undertaking.
That, you're right, was the effort, really, to make this happen. You know, Lightbox Photographic Gallery is quite active in this community, and Michael and Chelsea did choose the Lightbox representative artists whom they thought would be best, and then we did the same on our side. So it was a true joining. The artists, you know, had 3-4 months to get their stuff together, and I will say not everybody was able to pull it together.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that has to do with being an artist or even being a photographer or whatever, but the people that did put the work in, you know, it's really compelling work. So
it absolutely is that. And of course, we're talking about the Confessions, the collaboration art show between the Cannon Beach Arts Association and Lightbox Photographic Gallery here in Astoria. And we invite you to go and participate and see the shows. Can you tell us again when the shows are starting? You're having an opening reception this evening, yes? Oh, Roger?
Well, I think there might be a little bit of a misunderstanding. There is only one venue for the show.
So
the way you're talking about it, it sounds as though you're suggesting that there's two venues.
My understanding was there was a portion going to be done at Lightbox.
No, it's just the one show at the Cannon Beach Gallery, but the collaborative portion of it is that Lightbox selected half the show and Cannon Beach selected half the show.
So, I understand.
So
thank you.
So nobody will show up at Lightbox expecting
thank
to see
you. I was going to head downtown after work. Yes, I was. Thank you very much for clearing that
well,
up.
Well, you can still actually go to Lightbox. They do, I believe, have their members exhibit up right now.
Yes, they do indeed. Yes, they do. And there's always Lightbox is just one of the many nifty galleries that we have here in our story. But, of course, we're talking today about the show that's appearing at the Cannon Beach Art Gallery. And that show will run how long?
About 6 weeks. And the opening is Saturday, tomorrow evening from 5 to 7. There will be some snacks and beverages and some witty banter and maybe a priest or a confessional. Who knows?
That sounds good. Andrea, what do you have for us just before we take off here?
Well, I think that Lightbox has been such a great addition to the coastal arts community. I try to get in there whenever I'm up in Astoria. Their focus on the photographic art is really impressive. As a lifelong photographer, I've often been disappointed to be put into a different category than other artists as a photographer, that you're a photographer, not an artist. So that's an interesting place to be as someone who's done all kinds of art. So it's just really nice to see that merge with what the Cannon Beach Gallery does.
Let's do talk about that just a minute, the difference between, as Andrea was touching on, the perception of photography versus quote-unquote art. When I think as long as I've been aware of photographs, and that would be Matthew Brady in the Civil War, the first photographer using the plates and things like that. Not only was he reporting news, but we can't deny that 200 years later, those images, those that remain, are incredibly powerful as pieces in themselves. At what point do you think photography is able to transcend into art? Does it have to deal with, is it just the capture of a perfect image, or does there have to be some manipulation to create that piece?
Well, you're asking a pretty large and general philosophical
and
question.
And we've got about 5 minutes to deal with this. Oh, that's great.
Well, this debate has been going on since, you know, the mid-18th century in France, mm-hmm. Actually, it was mostly painters who began doing early photography, so there was that link with the arts immediately. But, yeah, it's been debated, and photography for many years was treated like a sort of stepchild by museums, but that's all gone away now. You know, it's almost not an issue, although perhaps in the minds of the public, and because photography is such a democratic medium, everybody thinks they can, you know, do a great shot and so forth.
Good
and,
point.
And sure, people do take a great shot once in a while, but I think that what distinguishes the photographic artist is the ability to create bodies of work that have a consistent level of expertise and evocative, you know, strength to them. And that's what makes art. But really, you're looking at a visual image, so whether it's a painting or, you know, if it moves you as a painting or if it moves you as a photograph, what's the difference? You're being moved, right?
Exactly, exactly. Don, Roger, Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today on Arts Live and Local. I'm going to play a little music to let our guests transition out, but one more time with dates and times of the show.
Saturday, January 16th at the Cannon Beach Gallery in Midtown Cannon Beach from 5 to 7 p.m.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. We are going to be right back with Drew Herzig and Greg Noakes. So stay tuned. Listening to music by Eugene Friesen here on Arts Live and Local here on Coast Community Radio 91.9. And joining me here in the studio now, on behalf of the Lewis and Clark National Historical Park and the In Their Footsteps series, it's my pleasure to welcome Astoria Councilman Drew Herzig and Greg Noakes. Gentlemen, welcome to the studio today. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And Drew is here to introduce and, I guess, give moral support to our author, Greg Noakes. Greg is here because he is going to be talking about his book, Breaking Chains, Slavery on Trial in the Oregon Territory at the next In Their Footsteps series. Drew, when is that going to be?
Well, actually, let me back you up a bit. I'm here for the Lower Columbia Diversity Project, and Greg is going to be speaking at the Astoria Public Library tonight at 6 o'clock as part of their After Hours program.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. He previously spoke at the Lewis and Clark In Their Footsteps at Fort Clatsop, where I heard him and said, we've got to get this gentleman back and do a presentation for part of our Martin Luther King Weekend events.
Oh, absolutely. We do. The stories that we're going to be talking about in the Breaking Chain Slavery on Trial concerns primarily the case of Holmes versus Ford, which was the only slavery case adjudicated in Oregon pre-Civil War courts. Greg Noakes, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself, how you come to write these fantastic historical books about Oregon, and what we can expect to hear this evening.
Well, thank you, Drew, and thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here in Astoria. I'm a journalist of 40 years experience, worked for the Associated Press in many different places around the globe, and lastly with the Oregonian. And I retired in 2003 and to start a second career as a writer and lecturer on Oregon history. I am a native of Oregon, that's important to point out. Attended Willamette University and had a year at Harvard on a fellowship. And I came across my first book, the story from my first book, Massacred for Gold, on the massacre of Chinese. I came across that while I was a reporter at the paper. And then when I retired, I thought, this needs to be a book. This is the worst crime ever committed against the Chinese. And so that became a book, and Oregon State University Press has published it. And then I wanted to do another book, and I bounced these ideas off my brother one day, and he said, why don't you write about Reuben Shipley? And I said, well, who is Reuben Shipley? And he said, he was a slave brought to Oregon by one of our ancestors. I was blown away. I had no idea there was
your personal ancestors.
Personal ancestors.
Interesting.
I had no idea there was any family connection to slavery, and certainly no idea there'd ever been black slaves in Oregon.
That is, I think that's something that very few of us realize. Even though we might be aware of problems with the Chinese, I think we're a little more familiar with that. I for one, did not know that there was actually slaves and slaveholders and slave-supporting laws here in the territory for quite some time. Talk to us a little bit about what you discovered then as you were researching this case. How did he come in that time, Holmes, to be able to bring a case to this court, slavery at that time in
well,
our
it's
history?
A remarkable,
it's incredible.
It's a remarkable story, and the slavery case is the center of the book. He was brought out from Missouri in 1843 and by a slave owner who brought six slaves out to Oregon. And at the time, Oregon had a law against slavery, and the settlers who did bring slaves out usually gave them their freedom within a few years. They wanted the slaves to help them start their farms. But Nathaniel Ford, who brought Robin Holmes and his wife and family out, kept them much longer. And so in 1850, Robin Holmes was agitating for his freedom, saying the other slaves are getting their freedom. You would give me mine. And Ford made this deal with him. Well, you go to California, mine gold for me, and I'll give you your freedom when you get back. So far, so good. That's what happened. So Holmes got his freedom in 1850, but Ford kept his children. And so that started this process toward the lawsuit. Now, this is quite remarkable that a former slave, illiterate, and as we know, slaves are very seldom ever taught to read and write, would in a state hostile to African Americans, and that's part of Oregon's long history, would bring a suit against his former slave owner, who was then serving in the territorial legislature. And that suit dragged on for 15 months. No judge wanted to make a ruling in the case, because on one hand you had a law against slavery, on the other hand you had a former slave suing this very important guy.
A state legislator. That point needs to be made again. He was a very powerful man himself in the state.
Yes, it was a territorial legislature. Mm-hmm. He served five terms in the territorial legislature. And the town of Rickrell is built almost entirely on his former property in Polk County. So he was a big deal. And to me, Robin Holmes is one of the unsung heroes of American history. Being able to bring this suit in this kind of a climate with being illiterate is just a remarkable story to me. And he did prevail. I mean, I will go to the bottom line of my book. He did prevail because of a very sympathetic judge named George Williams, who came out to, from New York and was appointed by President Franklin Pierce.
But that's what it took to actually get that case to move, was action from the president sending out a totally as impartial a judge as he possibly could find.
That's right. That's right.
And that's what broke it.
Right. That's what broke it. And this, it was George Williams' ruling in 1853 that really established that slavery was unlawful in Oregon. Even though there had been a law on the books, nobody was enforcing it. It was kind of fuzzy as to what its significance was. But Williams ruled that slavery really was illegal in Oregon. However, nobody enforced it. And while George Williams' ruling freed the Holmes children and ostensibly returned them to Holmes, Nathaniel Ford kept one of the girls. Mary Jane Holmes kept her and gave her away or sold her to somebody else, a family member. And to come full circle on the story, if I may, the slave brought by my ancestor ended up marrying Mary Jane Holmes, and Nathaniel Ford, you know, charged Robin Holmes, Reuben Shipley, $700, saying, "You can't take her because she's my property. You have to pay me."
For heaven's sakes, these are incredible, powerful stories. Drew, the mission of the Lower Columbia Diversity Project is to engage and proactively talk about these incredible issues that still are part of our culture, you know, telling these stories. Can you imagine not being able, you know, Greg was interested in hearing about the history of his family and that very powerful and difficult time. We're going to be celebrating Martin Luther King Day on Friday. Talk to us about the importance of reviewing these stories, of not forgetting what has happened, and in fact, of going to the effort, as Greg has done, of discovering stories to learn about ourselves.
Thanks, Kate. It's been very important for the Diversity Project to keep excavating Oregon's troubled history around racism. We've had Emily Drew from Willamette University. We've had Walida Imarisha. They've reminded us that even though Oregon entered the Union as a free state, it entered as a whites-only state. And that law was in the Constitution until 1923, I believe. Greg Nooks will refer to that in his presentation tonight. We don't know that, or we forget it, or we choose to forget it, but Oregon has been a white utopia for a long time, and the message is still out there. That's why people coming from other states remark on the lack of diversity here in Oregon. Nobody is at fault for that, but we need to be aware of it. We need to understand what message our history and our culture is sending out to the rest of the country about who really belongs in Oregon and who doesn't. So these community conversations, they're touchy subjects, but they're important for us to excavate and acknowledge that this is our history, whether we like to own it or not. It's there, and we need to recover it. And Mr. Nooks has done an incredible job recovering these narratives. He will talk tonight about the difficulty. Nobody was writing biographies of slaves in Oregon. A few of them left some journals, some notes, some entries, some memoirs, and he's done a great job recovering them. I don't want to give it all away in the interview. I want people to come to the library tonight at 6 o'clock, but it's really a remarkable excavation of part of Oregon's very troubled history around racism.
There can't have been, as Drew alluded to, a great deal of actual written history. You've seen some journals. How difficult and how long painstaking has the research into the lives of these people been?
Well, the research goes on. In my book, I allude to the probability there were as many as 35 black slaves in Oregon. Since the book has come out, I've now learned of so many more, there's probably as many as 75 black slaves. Now, that's not very many. You consider Missouri had something like 600,000. Nationally, there was this incredible number of 4 million. So the fact that Oregon had 75 slaves in terms of numbers, one might say, well, that's not so important. But we have forgotten that history as part of our history. The fact there are black slaves here at all, to me, is a remarkable story, and almost as remarkable, even more remarkable, was during Oregon's early history, there was, in effect, exclusion laws, even written into the Constitution, that prevented African Americans from coming here. Now, they were seldom enforced, but that didn't matter because the word went out nationally that Oregon is hostile to people of color. And as a result, there was no incentive for people of color to come to that kind of a situation. So it's one of the reasons we're such a white state.
Can you talk about the differences? They might be subtle, and it might be a difference with or without a distinction between those exclusion laws that applied to the black people, to the African American, as opposed to the Chinese who were here, who were serving more or less some sort of function in the strata in our cities and that's and the building of the West, and yet not participating fully as citizens by any stretch.
No, in fact, the Constitution banned Chinese from mining, even though Chinese mined a great deal. No, they were also non-citizens. In fact, the Constitutional Convention debated whether to have an exclusion law against Chinese as well as blacks. And they decided not to do that because they were concerned that, well, maybe people like having Chinese as servants and workers, which they were doing, and they might then not approve of an exclusion law that excluded both races. But so they dropped the Chinese from that law and just applied it to blacks. Of course, we know in 1882, Congress passed a national exclusion law against Chinese.
It just gets more and more muddled as locally they try to tiptoe through those very ugly tulips of yes, you may, and no, you may not. That's incredible.
Kate, it takes just a generation for these things to be forgotten. If we don't want to remember these things because they cast aspersions on our history or they're embarrassing to us, just one generation is all it takes for these things to be forgotten.
Well, then, Drew, talk to us a little bit about, just in the last few minutes, we are looking at these very difficult things, and you know, we keep talking about it's difficult, it's embarrassing, and every time anyone brings up things like this, it's, oh, why do we need to hear about this now? We knew about it. You've talked a little bit about why it's important for us to be remembering these things, but why should... Do we necessarily need to face these things with shame? If we can look at them straight on and straight ahead, can't we as a new generation take that information and just go forward with it?
Yes, if we do take it in. It shouldn't be shameful to face this. It should be part of our moral obligation, I feel. Similar to South Africa with their truth and reconciliation. You can't have reconciliation without acknowledging the truth. Whether we're talking about the displacement of American Indians, the Chinook people, the Chinese, African Americans, the past is present. Those communities still feel that discrimination. They are actually suffering from it. The Chinook still do not have federal tribal recognition. So it's not something that's over and done with and we just have to write it into the history books, give them a chapter somewhere. We have to acknowledge that the damage is still being done to these communities in the present. And unless we acknowledge the historical roots of this and start to dismantle the structures that have been around, as Greg says, for generations, that have become invisible to us who benefit from them because they don't affect us that way. If we can do that, we don't have to be ashamed. We can be proud of the fact that we faced the truth and achieved reconciliation.
Well said. We need to know how far we've come and how far we still need to go.
Oh, that's excellent. Drew and Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to appear. We're going to be talking. We want to review one more time what the event this evening, and then I want to talk to you a little bit about Monday, January 18th, and what's going to be happening actually on Martin Luther King Day proper. So remind us one more time about the event this evening, please.
Tonight it's part of the Astoria Library's After Hours program. They do a great program on Friday evenings, about one a month, and this month's selection is Greg Noakes talking about slavery at the end of the Oregon Trail. And we put this together with the Library and the Diversity Project as part of an extended Martin Luther King weekend, wanting to give some content to the national holiday. So the presentation tonight, bringing it home to Astoria and Oregon. And then Monday night, we're having our annual candlelight walk starting at 5:30 in front of the Liberty Theater. Everyone is welcome to attend just to honor the legacy and the memory of one of our great American prophets, Martin Luther King Jr.
And Drew, I'd appreciate it when we go out. You've got a quote here from Martin Luther King Jr. Right after the all ages are welcome. Would you mind just as leave that with our audience, food for thought for a Martin Luther King Day weekend?
A quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that.
Please join us for a shared meal in the Fellowship Hall of Police Lutheran Church and for the candlelight walk at 5:30 p.m. at the corner of 12th and Commercial Streets in Astoria. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Kate.
And this is Arts Live and Local here on Coast Community Radio. It's been an extremely full show today, and it just keeps getting better. Right now we have with us author, book reviewer, and musician Jim Stewart. He's going to present his new book, Ochoco Reach, at the Cannon Beach Company, Saturday at 7 p.m. It's an Ironwood novel, which I assume means there's a series. Yes, Jim?
Well, there's a series in my head.
A series in his head. Jim, I know that you're an author and a regular reviewer for the Portland Book Review. Talk to us a little bit about your background, and then I can't wait to start talking about Mr. Ironwood.
Well, let's see. My background, I spent a lot of time on the North Coast in the 70s. Lived here, met my wife here, and she's put up with me for over 40 years now, so I call her Saint Laura. And then I just ended up in Portland because I wasn't making a living. I couldn't make a living playing music here, so we moved to Portland, and I was able to make a living for a while playing music, but it was touch and go. It was hard to do, and we had some hard times and some good times. But we were all, it worked out. It worked out fine, and I was able to finish some schooling and go back to work and actually make a living. And it was all good.
So you've written is this your first novel?
This is my first novel. It's not my first attempt at a novel, but it's my first novel. Yeah.
How long have you been working now to develop as a writer?
All of my life, literally all mm-hmm. of my life. I started when I was five. Music and writing happened at the same time.
And what do you play?
I play guitar.
Excellent.
I'm a guitar player. I can play a scale on anything. I was just, while waiting for my turn today, I went down to and poked my head into Teal's Music, and because I had worked down there in the 70s, and it was good to just stick my head in there. It's all changed, of course, but writing happened. I started drawing pictures and adding captions and telling stories, and that's what it really is, telling stories. Music and writing, it's telling stories, yeah.
Well, your Mike Ironwood character is really nifty. I have, thanks to the miracle of the 21st century, I was able to download a copy of the book this afternoon, and I'm about on chapter 8.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that really caught me right off the bat was it starts out, well, first of all, it takes place, as you tell our audience, in the ranch country, high plains of central Oregon and Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And the character Mike Ironwood is... Well, I would say he's a rancher, yes, part-time?
He grew up on the ranch, yeah.
He grew up on a ranch. Yeah. He's a private detective. But the thing that makes him unique is he is a man of, let's say, hyper-incredible perception.
Yeah, he's pretty perceptive,
He seems to be always firing on all cylinders, hearing voices in the air, the movement of the wind, the flick of someone's eyelash is all giving him information. And in fact, one of my favorite sentences, it was right at the top of the book as you were reading it, he talks about the girl that comes into that meets up with him to get the crime solved. And he said it created a buzz in his head like a Balinese gong bang.
Yeah.
Gong band.
Yes.
A Balinese gong band.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a very nifty, nifty image.
Well, thank you. I stole that, actually. I stole that from Leo Kottke, who I was listening to him talk, and he was recounting the story of when he first met John Fahey. And John was listening to a Balinese gong band. And Leo's trying to figure out, wait a minute. So, but that image has always stuck with me. I mean, how odd is that? So and when it happens on the page, I mean, usually I write stuff like that all the time and people talk me out of it, through the editing process. no, nobody's going to get that. Mm-hmm. But nobody even asked me to strike that or change it. So I figured, okay, we'll go with it.
It's a nifty image. Mm-hmm. Like I said, who you are working with, of course, now you're published, or Ochoco Reach is published.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at a copy here. Does Laura serve as your first editor and critic? Would you pass things by your wife?
Yeah, she reads. She reads, and she has, and she doesn't. She doesn't tell me what I want to hear. She tells me the truth from her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So if she has a question about something, she's right up front with it, and that's really helped several times. Whether I like it or not is immaterial. You know, but I trust her implicitly. And then there's an editor, a professional editor. If anybody out there wants to write a novel, find an editor.
Because you can't do it yourself. How did you do this?
Let's see. My editor is a wonderful woman named Kristen Thiel, and I knew I needed an editor. I mean, I had 120,000 words, and in the genre, a publisher wants 80, you know. So I was like, I had all this stuff, and I knew I needed to pare it down. And but when I would go through and read it, I was not ruthless. I couldn't be ruthless enough. So I just started looking, and I asked people in the writing community in Portland, give me a name, give me something, you know, and so I narrowed it down to a couple of people, and then I wanted to meet face to face. I'm not just going to send my baby to somebody I had never met. So, and I found that was a little odd. It was perceived as a little odd. But Kristen said, sure, I'll hook up with you. So,
well, the days of sending your manuscript just out there and then getting the rejection letter, that's somewhat over now. Are you expected now as a new author to, for example, break in online or e-publish or self-publish? How are you able to grab the attention of that editor?
That's a good question.
To work in print.
Yeah, the answer is all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily want to publish it myself for several reasons that I'm not even sure of, but it wasn't my first choice. You know, I wanted to find an agent and go a traditional route. If you self-publish, then everything's on you, you just have to deal with all that stuff, the promotion and the marketing, and I'm challenged that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I just knew that I needed some help, so I went to the editor, trusting the process. I didn't know anything about, I guess. Trusting that it would be like a novel. I would discover it as I went along, because I don't do outlines or any of that stuff.
And was that the way it happened for you?
Yeah, yeah. I got it edited. I ended up meeting a couple of different writers. There's a woman who wrote a sort of a paranormal novel involving the ghost of Meriwether Lewis, and she and I became friends online, and it turns out that she told her publisher about me, and then they asked me,
mm-hmm.
Well, they told me what the deal was, and I said, huh, I thought about it and thought about it, and a friend of mine in Portland who has written several novels, and he's one of my heroes. I asked him about it. I said, look, there's this small press in South Carolina has made me an offer. What do you think? And he wrote me back, within 45 seconds and said, go for it and don't look back.
Sounds like you've had some good luck to go along with your talent and a little bit of kismet in things happening in the right places.
And the book follows one of those threads, too, throughout the characters.
Well, another thread that I want to talk about that the Ironwood books will follow, and the character of Mike Ironwood in particular, is that he has a strong association and an influence still by his years in Vietnam and his service in Vietnam. That's something that even in your biography you talk about as well as something that informs you artistically and personally. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. I right up front, I never served in any military organization. The reason that has captivated me, I was of age in the 60s and managed to avoid going to Vietnam through luck and a little bit of kismet. But I also was in a rock and roll band, and we played on Camp Pendleton and around Camp Pendleton. So I got to know a lot of these guys who were, you know, maybe 3 years older than me.
I was going to say about your same age.
About my same age, so I got to know these guys, and they shared things with me that absolutely blew me away. You know, about their experiences and how they were trying to deal with it, so I was still in my mid to late teens when I figured out that people that go through the military and serve their countries, whether they were drafted or volunteered or whatever, but that sacrifice is profound. And it's stayed with me all these years. And the dedication of the book, I dedicate it to Laura, but I also dedicate it to the veterans, the Vietnam veterans, those who came back, those who didn't, and those who haven't yet.
Well, and if I might, it is for Laura and for the veterans who served in Vietnam, those who came back, those who didn't, and those who haven't yet. Very powerful. But there's a lot of humor in your novel as well.
I have to say, it's
it made me smile, like I said, right from the get-go. And just the way his mind works and the way he is thinking his way through the process as he builds the case, he's got a tremendous sense of humor. Talk about, you're writing in the first person, how much of Mike Ironwood is you and how much of you is Mike Ironwood?
Well, that's a tough one.
It's unfair.
I'm sure there's some stuff going on there. I do have a rich fantasy life. Always have. I've had other friends tell me as they've read it that they read things and it could be, they say, "That's you talking." I said, "Well, where else am I going to come from?" But Mike Ironwood is not me, and I am certainly not Mike Ironwood, but that's one of the beauties of the whole process. You know, as a songwriter, as a story writer and a storyteller, you're assuming an identity, and you're telling this story in the first person, third person, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the narrator, you're assuming an identity of the narrator, and it's natural. People... they want to believe that this is really you. I mean, you know, how many songs have you heard that are very powerful and either uplifting or dark so everybody assumes that the songwriter, that came out of their personal life.
Oh, yes, or the actor that gets way too blamed for the roles that he plays.
Exactly.
So.
You know, but that's... A narrator, you're assuming an identity to create and tell this story. Sometimes you're in there, and sometimes you're in a just a fiction. I mean, it's a story. You get to make it up. That's the beauty of doing it. That's what I love about it.
Do you have a daily process, a regimen to follow to make sure that you get the work done?
You got to touch it. I mean, if you're in a project like a novel, you've got to at least touch it every day. And William Stafford said it beautifully. He said, you know, if you're there and it's not going right, don't get up and quit. Just lower your expectations, which I think is absolutely brilliant. But ideally, I like to start in the morning. I like to write first thing in the morning, before I'm even fully awake, because sometimes your subconscious is right there, and I find that useful. If it's not there, then I lower my expectations. and then edit. Then I actually have a day job, and I have to do that. But then later in the day, I'll edit what I wrote that morning. And then in the evening, who knows? It just mm-hmm. depends on how much sleep I get. And mm-hmm. you know, but the only process I really have is if you're in the middle of a project like I was with Ochoco Reach, you have to touch it every day. Every
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to sit there for hours every day, but you at least have to touch it.
Excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, talk to us about, you're going to be appearing tomorrow evening at the Cannon Beach Book Company.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Saturday at 7 p.m. to talk about your book. Are you going to be reading from your book?
Yeah, I'm going to read. I'm not going to read a lot. I've been to enough book readings, and you know, sometimes the magic works and sometimes it doesn't. But I'll pick something that I'll try to set it up properly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reading, but what's fun for me is asking, you know, getting questions going. People, if they're at the reading, then they've probably at least looked at the book, mm-hmm. or they know me. That's another thing, because mm-hmm. I've played music for 40 years up and down this part of the coast, and so people know it. If they don't know me, they know who I am, and so they have questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that give and take back and forth, that questions. And it's a marvelous little bookstore, 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. It'll be fun.
Jim Stewart, author of Ochoco Reach, appearing tomorrow evening at the Cannon Beach Book Company with his novel, to read and to answer your questions. Jim, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
It was my pleasure.
We'll enjoy the event tomorrow evening. And in your honor, and in the honor of Mike Ironwood, we've got a little Balinese gong band to take us out.
That's brilliant. Good stuff.
And this is Kate Brister. I have been filling in for Carol Newman. She will be back next week. Lucky for all of us. And to take us out, I'm going to let you know what's going on around the North Coast this evening. And we'll start right out with the Cannon Beach Book Company is hosting the evening with Portland author and musician Jim Stewart. Tomorrow evening at 7 p.m., reading from Ochoco Reach, an iron new book, and singing a few songs. You won't want to miss that. Homemade treats will be served. The event is free and open to the public. Seth Titchener, philosophy instructor at Clatsop Community College, offers a lecture entitled Existentialism and Waiting for Godot, Friday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Astoria Performing Arts Center at 16th and Franklin in Astoria. A book reading and discussion of The Extraordinary Voyage of Kamom, A Tsunami Boat Comes Home, will take place Thursday, January 21st at 2 p.m. at the Columbia River Maritime Museum in Astoria. And author Gideon Four Mukwai will be presenting his Unsung Heroes, Stories from Different Cultures, at the Tillamook Library on January 15th at 2 p.m. And another note of note, AIFF and the Liberty Theater will present the comedy film Noises Off, 2 p.m. Sunday, January 17th at 1203 Commercial Street in Astoria. For more information, go to libertytheater.org.